The oldest person in town keeps dying. Yesterday, the oldest person in the town died 7 times. By the end of this count, the oldest person in town will have died and died and died again.
From KCRW and McSweeney's, this is The Organist. We begin today's episode with a short story by Kevin Moffitt.
Some outlast their bodies. Others are outlasted by them. Some dream of escaping themselves, scuttling free of their skin like naked crabs in search of a new body. Our town is filthy with new bodies, unblemished, supple, vacant, but they can't. They all die after eating their last meal. The oldest person in town wants you to come closer. He has a secret. You know, the giant safari painting hanging in his nursing home activity room? It terrifies him. He always keeps his back to it while doing activities. Subconsciously, he might connect it to the time he... No. The oldest person in town's secret is now that she never goes a day without smoking a cigar and eating a thick slice of hogshead cheese. Hogshead cheese isn't cheese at all, but a terrine of congealed brain meat suspended in aspic. One of her middle husbands wouldn't let her have it in the house because he claimed it was hobo food. A man who ate pickled hard-boiled eggs, trying to disparage hogshead cheese? No, sir. She served it every so often without him knowing, put it in stews, and in a noodle casserole she called truck. "These chitlins in here?" he'd ask. The man had no quarrel with chitlins. She wasn't happy when he died, and she wasn't unhappy either. Dying will be easy. It will be like reaching the end of a long day without anything left to dread or shepherd or forecast or unbutton. No more musical chairs. No more music. The oldest person in town pictures death as a stout nurse pushing an empty wheelchair. No, the oldest person in town now pictures death as a nice, light-skinned usher with a flashlight, walking patiently beside her with his hand on her back. The oldest person in town still remembers when there were ushers in movie theaters. Real ushers who wore velvet uniforms with piping and epaulettes and would see you to your seat. Nothing much of importance has changed in her lifetime except that more people used to wear uniforms. Cats seem a little nicer now, and every story is her story. She remembers inventing thunder and laughter and the alphabet and being rescued from a tower and the time the other villagers made her sew a scarlet A to her work shift. She remembers her first unsteady steps on the moon, the capsule door opening, the twin sensations of rising and falling as she hopped out, the agony of being born again. The oldest person in town lost track of her age 27 years ago. Two men come into her room, one with a camera around his neck and another with a vase full of flower-shaped fruit. And he says, "You did it. Can you believe it?" And she says, "No, I can't." She reaches for the knife and says, "Put whatever that is down and slowly walk away."
That was The Oldest Person in Town by Kevin Moffitt, as performed by Edgar Oliver. If you missed part of it because somebody was screaming in the backseat like a baby, possibly, you might consider picking up a copy of McSweeney's issue 49, just out. It includes this story, along with new work from Roxane Gay, Jess Walter, T.C. Boyle, other excellent writers. You can order it at McSweeney's.net. Kevin Moffitt is the author of three books, and he's at work on a fourth, a collection of fragments called Some Wonder. He also wrote the classic piece that Nick Offerman performed in the very first episode of this program.
Never before has so little meant so much to so many. Podcast. Say it with me. Podcast. Please, I don't want to be the only one saying it.
Edgar Oliver last lent his voice to The Organist when he read Jimmy Chen's short fiction about the pain of tiny headphones against his oversized head. After the break, we'll turn to another, even more reliable source of terror and pleasure, the writing of H.P. Lovecraft. We'll be right back.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
If you went to see the movie Alien Covenant this spring, you may not have known it, but you were inside something.
What happened here?
You were inside the imaginative world of the writer H.P. Lovecraft. His stories, published in pulp magazines in the 1920s and 30s, set a tone of cosmic dread that went on to influence the alien movies, shows like Stranger Things, and novelists including Stephen King and Neil Gaiman. And Paul Lafarge, whose latest novel, The Night Ocean, takes Lovecraft as its subject, or as one of its subjects. It's a fictionalized investigation into Lovecraft's relationship with one of his fans, a teenager named Robert Barlow. Lafarge is the author of five novels that abound in frame tales and historical figments. You know you're in a Paul Lafarge novel when you're having trouble telling the difference between historical fact and novelistic fancy, and you increasingly don't care. Lafarge talked with The Organist's Matt Frassica from his house in upstate New York. Here's Paul Lafarge.
H.P. Lovecraft was one of the great American horror writers. He wrote stories which he himself described as belonging to the genre cosmic horror, not ghosts and clanking chains and, you know, demons and so on, but monstrous alien beings from beyond the stars, which ended up on Earth. They're these enormous, crazy-making monsters against which humanity does not stand a chance. For me, the story that I remember best is probably one of Lovecraft's better-known stories. It's called The Call of Cthulhu. Cthulhu was one of Lovecraft's more famous creations. He's this kind of octopus-headed monster that lives at the bottom of the ocean and wakes up, you know, every so often to try to destroy the world. And it's a beautifully constructed story that haunts me in some ways to this day. And the opening line is kind of famous. So it begins,
"The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little. But someday, the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein, that we shall either go mad from the revelation, or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age."
I mean, that's kind of Lovecraft in a nutshell. The more we learn about the universe, the more awful things we're going to find out, the more terrified we're going to be. And either we're going to go mad, or we're going to have to start a new dark age to protect ourselves from our own knowledge. And, you know, anyway, The Call of Cthulhu is about this guy has inherited a locked box of papers from his uncle who has died mysteriously. And the papers contain clues to a Cthulhu cult, and he follows the clues and slowly puts together the pieces of this story, which is that Cthulhu is waking up, that there are these cultists who are trying to summon him from the bottom of the ocean. And the cultists don't, but ironically, some hapless sailors who are wandering, bungling around the South Pacific, land on the island where Cthulhu is asleep, and they end up waking him up, and he comes to life, and he eats them like potato chips. So this is, he's telling us about the diary that some guy named Johansson has kept. And he says,
"Poor Johansson's handwriting almost gave out when he wrote of this. Of the six men who never reached the ship, he thinks two perished of pure fright in that accursed instant. The thing cannot be described. There is no language for such abysms of shrieking and immemorial lunacy, such eldritch contradictions of all matter, force, and cosmic order. A mountain walked or stumbled. God, what wonder that across the earth a great architect went mad and poor Wilcox raved with fever in that telepathic instant. The thing of the idols, the green, sticky spawn of the stars, had awaked to claim his own. The stars were right again, and what an age-old cult had failed to do by design, a band of innocent sailors had done by accident. After vigintillions of years, great Cthulhu was loose again and ravening for delight."
I mean, I love that, you know, the green, sticky spawn of the stars. I'm also fascinated by that last phrase, ravening for delight. It's like Cthulhu is ravening for delight. No one seems to enjoy themselves in Lovecraft stories, except the cultists and the monsters. Everyone else is kind of, you know, going from library to library. But Cthulhu comes out and he just wants to have a good time, which in his case involves eating sailors. But, you know, whatever, that's his thing. Lovecraft grew up in Providence, and his father went mad and died in a Providence insane asylum when Lovecraft was, I think, 8 or 9 years old. And Lovecraft's mother went insane and died in the same insane asylum when Lovecraft was in his late teens or early 20s. And after his mother died, he experienced a kind of liberation, and he fell in love with a woman named Sonia Green, and Lovecraft moved to Brooklyn. He couldn't find work in New York. Sonia was supporting him, and Lovecraft was, by upbringing and I guess also by temperament, a bigot. He was someone who believed in the superiority of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants to more or less everyone else. And that had been kind of a feature of his character, but living in Brooklyn brought out the worst in him. And finally, Lovecraft fled back to Providence, where he spent the rest of his life. And he died of intestinal cancer in 1937 at the age of 46. I encountered him as a kid. I stumbled on his work through the game Dungeons and Dragons, which had it's called Deities and Demigods, and it was a collection of all of these different gods taken from works of fantasy and horror and other kinds of fiction. And Lovecraft's creatures were all there, and they were these giant, awful monsters with tentacles. And I thought, wow, that sounds great. I really want to read this guy's stories. So I tracked his books down and I read them. And there was something about the atmosphere of doom that hung over Lovecraft's universe that really spoke to me as a kid growing up in New York City in the late 1970s and early 80s. You know, this was a time when nuclear war seemed like a real possibility, and, you know, also when New York City was kind of falling apart. So the sentiment that the planet and humanity were doomed really, you know, made sense to me. And I thought, well, why not be in on the joke? Why not, you know, be one of the people who knows the truth? So a friend of mine and I started a cult of Cthulhu. We made ourselves black robes, and we would go out at night with signs that said, "The end of the world is nigh, give to the cult of Cthulhu." And we would walk up and down Broadway, you know, at 2 or 3 in the morning, holding these signs and asking people for money. Two skinny 11-year-olds with glasses, wandering around the city at night. You know, in retrospect, I'm amazed that no one killed us. And then at a certain point, I got interested in other things, in other writers, in social activity. You know, I discovered girls and, you know, my interests shifted. And I set Lovecraft aside, and I think I had the feeling that he was a kind of an embarrassment, that he belonged to a phase of my life that I was better off not talking about. And then in 2005, I was the writer in residence at Bard College, and I met poet and novelist Robert Kelly, whose work I had admired for years, and I was very happy to meet him, and he invited me out to dinner, and I was thrilled and, you know, a little intimidated. And we were talking about this and that. And to my surprise, it turned out that Robert had also been a fan of H.P. Lovecraft. And so we started talking about Lovecraft. So Robert said, "And by the way, do you know the story of Lovecraft and Robert Barlow?" And I'd never heard Barlow's name before. Robert explained that Barlow had been a fan of Lovecraft's, and he invited Lovecraft to come visit him at his parents' house in Central Florida. And in the summer of 1934, Lovecraft went to see him. And it was, you know, it was kind of a strange visit. It was strange that Lovecraft, who was reclusive, more or less, and spent most of his time in Providence, traveled to Central Florida, really, you know, kind of in the middle of nowhere, So why did Lovecraft spend 6 weeks there? And the other thing that made it surprising is that Lovecraft was 43 in the summer of 1934, and Barlow had just turned 16. And so you think, gosh, you know, what was going on? Why did Lovecraft want to spend 6 weeks in the middle of nowhere with a 16-year-old fan? And it wasn't his only trip to see Barlow. He went back the next summer and spent about 2 months there, and Barlow came to visit Lovecraft in Providence. You know, they had a very close friendship, and Barlow was probably the person who was closest to Lovecraft, except for, or maybe even including, Lovecraft's wife, Sonia. And then there's Barlow. And Robert told me a little bit about him. He was Lovecraft's friend. He was a writer of weird fiction. He became Lovecraft's literary executor when Lovecraft died. He moved to the Bay Area. He became an experimental poet. And then he studied anthropology, moved to Mexico City, and became one of the world's great authorities on the civilization of the Aztecs. And then his life has a tragic end, which is that Barlow was gay, and one or maybe several of his students threatened to out him, to expose him as homosexual, unless he did something, unless he gave them better grades or changed the curriculum to suit their interests. He was so upset by this incident that he took an overdose of sleeping pills and died at the age of 32. So, you know, when Robert told me the story about Lovecraft and Barlow, I really did think, this is a fascinating story and I want to write a novel about it. And that was what became The Night Ocean. The title comes from a short story that Lovecraft and Barlow collaborated on. And I do summarize it in the book, so maybe I'll just read what I wrote.
It is about an artist who visits a resort town called Elston Beach at summer's end to rest a weary mind. He has been working on his entry for a mural competition. Now it's done and he wants a change of scene. The first mists of fall cover the sky and the town empties out. The artist eats dinner in a hurry. For some reason, he's afraid to be outside after dark. He mentions that there have been drownings at the beach. Even swimmers of a skill beyond the average have been lost, and their strangely mangled bodies washed up on shore days later. No one thinks too much about this. Days pass in which the artist is troubled by a perception of the brief hideousness and underlying filth of life. And meanwhile, the ocean gets colder and colder, and the sky gets darker and darker. Finally, the artist decides he's had enough of Elston Beach, and just then he gets a telegram informing him that he's won the mural competition. It doesn't make him happy. He stays up late one moonlit night, smoking a cigarette and watching the ocean, and sees a figure swimming with horrible ease and carrying something, a man, probably, on its shoulder. Then the figure disappears back into the ocean, and the artist leaves Elston Beach. And we never find out what the figures in the ocean were or what they wanted. The story leaves us with a sense of the futility of even trying to understand. We will vanish from the earth, the artist says, but the ocean will be around forever.
So that's the story. It's, if anything, even more melancholy than Lovecraft's work. You know, at least in Lovecraft, you find out who the monsters were, and you get Cthulhu ravening for delight. You know, the story occupies a kind of significant moment in both the Lovecraft and Barlow's lives. Barlow wrote the story probably in the summer of 1936, and Lovecraft made some changes to it, and Lovecraft died in 1937, so just a couple months after the story, The Night Ocean, was published. Neither of them wrote anything after that story.
Paul Lafarge's novel about H.P. Lovecraft and Robert Barlow is called The Night Ocean. The readings were performed by the actor Omar Mitwali. And that's our show. If you liked it, please leave us a review on our Apple Podcast page. And if that's too daunting for you, do what Yuri and his friend Lisa did. Find someone you trust and write your review of The Organist together.
So, what do you think of The Organist? She asked.
Oh, I love it. I love The Organist, I said, pretty convincingly.
Did you listen to the last episode?
The last episode?
The very last one, the most recent one.
The one about... Oh, yeah, yeah, I listened to it.
Did you like it?
Like it? I loved it.
She smiled, a long, knowing smile. I'm glad, she said, and picked up her black leather purse from the floor. I'm glad, she repeated.
Now it was me who smiled. Mine was a joyless smile, and I think it showed.
She put her hand inside her purse. The muscles in her arm tensed, as if she was gripping something tight.
How come? I asked.
Because if you really listen to it, you must know who I am. And you must know what to say in order to stop me from doing what I'm about to do.
Yuri Herrera is the author of Signs Preceding the End of the World, which the Guardian newspaper included on its list of the year's best fiction. He wrote this short piece for The Organist in collaboration with Lisa Dillman, who's translated all three of his novels. The Organist is produced by me with Ross Simonini. Our managing editor is Ben Bush. Our contributing editors are Jenny Amint, Naila Orr, David Weinberg, and Mike Dodge Weisskopf. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White. We're mixed and engineered at KCRW by Mario Diaz and Kat Yor. Our intern is Aaron Pelish. Actually, he's not our intern anymore. Aaron was recently poached by CNN, where he's now a news associate. And I can't tell you how many times The Organist has lost interns to CNN. Aaron must be the eighth or ninth to go that way. I don't know what it is, this apparent talent pipeline that runs in one direction only, from this podcast straight to the newsrooms of CNN. But I can say this, it ends now. We won't survive as a podcast for another year if this continues. Aaron Pelish is the last intern to leave The Organist for CNN. But while I can and do begrudge CNN deeply for their cavalier and injurious attitude toward this podcast, I cannot begrudge Aaron, who did great tireless work for us for more than a year. And so, as a tribute to him, I'd like to dedicate this, his favorite song, and the future of his career in journalism. Thanks, Aaron, and thanks for listening. Here's A House Is Not a Home by Luther Vandross.
A chair is still a chair, even when there's no one sitting there. But a chair is not a house, and a house is not a home when there's no one there to hold you tight.